What if they're not bad, they're just drawn that way? In honor of Suicide Squad, what cinematic villain deserves a turn as a hero for a change?
I'm Matt Patches, and maybe this will be the case in Luc Besson's new movie. I don't know. Joanne will have to tell us. But I'm actually going to go with Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, played by Gary Oldman in The Fifth Element.
I'm Joanna Robinson. I'm going to pick Ursula, voiced by the lovely Pat Carroll, still alive, from The Little Mermaid. Because what good could she do with those tentacles?
Wait, we already have her in a hero movie. It's called Pink Flamingo. Anyway.
Okay. Nice.
I'm Dave with a 7. And I was inspired by last week's spontaneous conversation about cloud villains. And I'm going to pick Hexus from Fern Gully. Because what happens? He's in that tree. He was in that tree for a long time.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I will confess that I misread this question and thought that it was exclusive to the superhero genre, and therefore I'm going with the obvious choice within that world, which is Loki, if only because I think that that is what a movie about villains that is done right, in which they are allowed to be actually villainous, could bring some fresh blood to the superhero waters.
Once again, in the end, David is the only person talking about superhero movies because he's obsessed with them.
Yeah,
obsessed.
Jesus, David.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 130.
130? 30. 130. 30, flirty, and whatever.
Thriving, thank you. 130 going on 113. For Tuesday, August 2nd, 2016, happy 40th birthday, Sam Worthington, star of Avatar. And... yeah, this is older Jai Courtney I'm talking about here. You
Who?
Remember him from such movies as
I just saw
one of the Terminators.
He's starring Jai Courtney, and thought it was Tom Hardy the entire time.
No,
literally only until I was complaining to a colleague about Jai Courtney's Tom Hardy's performance, and she was like, "Wait, he's not in that movie."
Tom Hardy was supposed to be in Suicide Squad, and Sam Worthington was never going. He was in Sabotage, another David Iyer film.
Wait, Sam Worthington? Oh,
you know what? I interviewed Sam Worthington for The Debt, and because he's so hairy, they gave him the nickname Chewy on that set. So happy birthday,
wow.
Chewy.
Who?
Exactly. Speaking of
you know
poo,
Chewbacca, you are lying. You are lying to everybody's face.
Speaking of who, do they really matter? Reviews for our podcast.
They do
that
matter.
People, no, the people leaving the reviews definitely matter. I'm sorry. I don't want people to misconstrue that. We don't matter, but maybe to some people we do, and I'll turn it over to David for new reviews.
In the cosmic dust of time, none of us matter, but I think that history will show that those
you,
who leave
Rust
us reviews
Cole.
On our podcast matter
it's
more than others.
Podcast.
We have three reviews tonight. The first is not so... nice. And so we're going to open them up with it first and then move on to happier thoughts. But Bougie Teed says, pretty good. I enjoyed this podcast, but a few things keep it from a rating of 5. He gave us a 4, he or she.
Oh, that's pretty good.
David is pretty pretentious, but I find him fascinating to listen to and entertaining, and I find myself often agreeing with many of the points he is making. Dave 7 is my favorite. If only the other people would give him a chance to speak. He has to do Storm of Spoilers just for a chance to be heard. Katie is forgettable. I've been listening a while.
Wait, who are we talking about? Okay.
I've been listening
Sam Worthington,
a while, and the show definitely improved with Joanna Robinson on board.
Oh, damn.
Joanna seems like the coolest girl on earth.
Boo.
And I enjoy when she pops up on every other podcast I listen
damn.
To.
No.
And now for the reason I did not give this a 5 and almost gave it a 3.5.
I kind of expected this. Any review
worst.
That starts with David talking about how he's great is always going to end with bashing me. Anyway, sorry, go.
I believe this review started with saying that I was pretty pretentious.
Faint praise.
For a second. Matt Patches is the worst. He is a douche who always interrupts people while they're speaking and always has the worst points of view.
Fair.
Now we move on to interesting.
Wait, the review just ends there?
Yes.
Wow.
That seems okay. Pretty. That seems pretty final.
I'm summoning my inner Sam Worthing to really stand up to. Oh, now I'm defeated.
Anyway. Now we move on to M.M. Nizzle, who says, interesting and funny. When I first started listening in April, I wasn't sure if I would like it. I liked Katie a lot, but David seemed too dismissive. Patches seemed the most fair, and Dave the most normal one. As I got better acquainted with the show, the host's chemistry and quirks, I really warmed to them. They are an eclectic group of critics and journalists, and shout out to Joanna, who is terrific. This podcast is not an echo chamber. The hosts disagree often, but never in a stubborn way. They are thoughtful and well-informed, and quite funny as well. I highly recommend this show for film buffs looking to hear a variety of opinions. The hosts are articulate and interesting. Glad I found it. And finally,
thank God for this person.
from Jeremy Schobel, who says, great job. I listen to every episode, well, except for obviously the review episodes of movies I haven't seen. I'm not a monster. But I do so begrudgingly when a core member is missing or when a guest is there as a replacement. To emphasize, guests are fine, but only when they're in addition to the four core members, not instead of. In parentheses, Katie's pregnancy is hugely inconveniencing.
I agree.
In short, I'm happy for the confluence of life events that led you four together, a genuinely interesting array of voices and tastes in a field that lacks that very thing. You're all my favorite. So this week we had a nice balance, a little bit of hate for everyone. A little bit of love for everyone. Call it even and move on.
I feel like that's our podcast in a nutshell. Anyway,
I don't. I know we don't do like a new segment on the show, but I did want to say really quickly that in honor of Katie's absence, I just thought I'd mention the news that broke today that Channing Tatum has been cast in a gender swapped reboot of Splash, which to me feels like co-starring Jillian Bell, someone else that Katie likes. So this just seemed like a gift to Katie Rich, and I cannot wait till she comes back from maternity leave to tell us all of her thoughts. But she did express in all caps to me via text message today, they got my letter. So
yes, I heard that the Channing Tatum Splash news made Katie pregnant again. So it's really exciting. No, that's disgusting. Anyway,
this time it's a baby.
Oh my God. It's a real gift of nature. Thanks everyone for all the reviews and keep on leaving them. Obviously it helps us climb the charts on iTunes, and you can really say anything and we'll read it. If this
we
little
will
bit of segment
read anything, just put it in the fucking teleprompter.
Look, I'm holding back tears as I close out this intro. So moving on.
So, guys, this Sunday, the 31st of July, Harry Potter's birthday, also J.K. Rowling's birthday, the Cursed Child Parts 1 and 2 rehearsal script book was released to much fanfare as the 8th installment. Well, I mean, to comparable fanfare.
Moderate fanfare. I walked past a midnight release party, and there were like four people in there, and it was the saddest thing.
Come on, my beautiful fiance went to a release party with her friends.
I ran into her on her way
there. David can
confirm. There's nothing wrong with going to a release party. I'm just saying, like, it wasn't quite the clamor of a rolling book. Okay, I'm so sorry I interrupted you. Please.
A real book? Is that what you did? You say a real book?
I said a rolling book. J.K. Rowling. Wow.
She. This is her book. I saw Joanna complaining about this on Twitter, and I just want to. I gotta stand up and preach. This is a J.K. Rowling product.
No, it's sanctioned fan fiction. Okay.
No way. This is like Andy Warhol creating art and his artists, his like warehouse people building his art for him. This is Ai Weiwei telling his foot soldiers to build. This is J.K. Rowling's creation through and through. Someone else wrote it because she's not a playwright. Come on, this is her art.
I mean, are we ready for the facts?
She's not a screenwriter either, but she has her name on a movie coming out this fall.
All right, I'm ready, Dave. Please give us actual truths.
So the Harry Potter on stage idea had been brewing ever since the movies had sort of started to wind down as a property, but nobody could come up with an idea that J.K. Rowling liked except Jack Thorne, who decided to extend the story rather than adapt something to the story. And then the rumor is she asked him very George R. Martin-like, what are the Harry Potter books about? And he said learning how to cope with death, and that was good enough for her. And so basically he started pitching a story that brought his favorite elements and everybody's favorite elements of the Wizarding World to the stage, along with a lot of cool stagecraft with one of his producers he'd worked with previously. And with J.K. Rowling, the three of them, Rowling. I have to correct myself.
Rowling, I yelled at Fliss
previously. Rowling. The three of them all created the story together. So it was more like they presented something to her and she said, here are the things that my characters would never do in this world. And presumably everything that's on the page has been blessed by her. In terms of what actually is from her and what is from the playwrights, I think is kind of obvious if you're familiar with either of their previous works. I've happened to have read some Thorne plays because I studied abroad in London one time.
Ooh, what plays? Got a bug what for plays? Theater.
What was the one about the... I don't remember off the top of my head. Let me Google while I find a list of all the Jack Thorne plays.
But so do you not agree with me, Patches, that like the scenario that Dave just described is sanctioned fan fiction?
I don't think so unless you consider Game of Thrones, the television show, to be fan fiction.
Some of the later seasons I do.
Oh, well, I mean, that's pretty broad strokes, and I think blowing it out of its definition in some ways.
You consider later seasons of Game of Thrones to be fan fiction?
I don't think these are fans writing it. I think they are writers writing for it, and are there artists collaborating with a main artist?
All right, I'll walk back from fan fiction, but okay. I see
where you're going with that idea.
She might have said, yes, okay, these are reasonable things that my characters would have done, but this is not a story written by J.K. Rowling.
But this is canon.
It is canon. Yeah, sanctioned.
So that's canon. That's important. Why it's not fan fiction.
Is it important? Well, all I'm just saying is, like, I'm not as excited about a script book not written by the woman who wrote the previous books.
And I think that's fair because as far as reading it, we got the book on Sunday. I read a lot of it. I'm almost done. I had already spoiled myself because at my heart, I'm a Dave 7. And so I kind of knew where it was all going, but I was excited to read it because I wanted to see if the dialogue played on the page. And it doesn't. It's not a very good read, to be quite honest. But it also got a glowing review out of the New York Times, and I'm excited to see it in stage form because it's really not meant to be read. I feel like this is J.K. Rowling doing fans a favor.
The stage play got a glowing review?
No. The play itself. It hasn't been, it's been in previews for the last 2 months. I mean, if people who listen to the show don't really know how theater works, I assume most people do, but, you know, the play has been quote-unquote open for 2 months, but it's been in previews, which is why we're only getting the rehearsal copy of the script. It's been changed, and now, to coincide with the release of the play in book form, the play is now open, and it's changed since then. But, so... You know, it got a glowing review out of the Times, and the stagecraft, you can read in the text, like, you wonder, how are they going to make papers kind of fly all over the stage and then pile up in a neat, orderly pyre? How are they going to do a centaur? How are they going to do all these spells and all this magic? It sounds astounding, but as you read it, you're really just kind of, like, drilling through plot, in a way. You can't get the actors, you can't get J.K. Rowling's... you know, prose out of this. That's where the acting comes in.
You exactly agree with me. I mean, that was my point, is that this is not the same as a Harry Potter book coming out. That's not to say if someone walked up to me with two tickets and like a plane ticket to London. Okay, one ticket to Harry Potter and a plane ticket to London is all I ask. And from the universe. And then I, of course, would go see it.
But
of course
it is
I would.
Potter.
I love the theater. It's interesting. I have spoiled myself entirely on what happens. I find it intriguing, but that
you're not
like,
gonna read it.
I might read it. I don't know. But like I don't feel a burning desire to in the same way that I would if J.K. Rowling herself had written another book, right? There's a huge difference.
I will say that I was under the impression that she wrote the play, and I lost I my interest was middling to begin with, but I lost all of it.
That makes no sense considering her involvement, I think. But I'm curious what Dave thinks did you get through
the books to begin with? So.
Did you get
through Yes, I did get through the book, and I'm going to go back, and my research turned up exactly the plays that I was thinking of. It was a play as part of like a way of talking about depression amongst young people. It was called Burying Your Brother in the Pavement. It was about a teenager whose younger brother died in like an accident, and he doesn't really feel any grief, so he ends up sleeping on the sidewalk outside of his home, and people sort of like come up and share thoughts with him. And then he also, because I knew him from there, he also did the adaptation of Let the Right One In, so I read that. So those are the Thorn things that I've read.
That's applicable.
Yeah, they're both kind of applicable because the play is about trying to parent children and children's relationship to their, you know, the generation before them and like the expectations of that. So to a certain degree, I could see the Jack Thorne in it because I saw something that was about trying to speak to like teenagers. And so while, you know, the bookcase is trying to like eat people or whatnot, there's actually a great relationship developed between the two male leads, Albus and Scorpius.
Which Joanna thinks is a gay metaphor, but that's...
Wait,
that's
what?
Which,
why?
Why?
Well, because Harry Potter like doesn't get into... he doesn't like see eye to eye with his son, supposedly because he gets into Slytherin, but basically there's a time jump that doesn't really discuss why they don't get along. We're just kind of all of a sudden in their fourth year, and see the peak of it.
I mean, I don't think it's because it's different. It's just because it's not Harry Potter. It's not what he has grown up. I mean, Harry Potter's such a broken character. Okay. I didn't read it that way because Harry Potter has so many issues to himself. He's such a broken human being. I mean, this is a kid who lived in under a stairwell for like 10 years. He has so many problems, and to be a parent, I think, is really fascinating. I didn't apply extended metaphor to the relationship he has with Albus, his son, in this play. I just think that it's really fucked up to be a father, and how can you possibly deal if it's not exactly your experience all over again? Anything different was going to screw with his relationship. And
well, I mean, that's what makes Harry bad, or like a bad father, by wanting to like overprotect in different times and sort of not seeing his son. But if he is the unseen child, like the prophecy at the end of the play says, what Joanna's saying is what Harry didn't see in his son is that he loves Scorpius. It's not he only needs one friend. And it's almost there, except the play decides to not do that at the end by having like Scorpius sort of like ask out Rose Granger Weasley. And there's this one scene that I think is a good example of what I would say is like a Jack Thorne addition to the story, which is a silent scene between the two on the moving staircases, which reads really weird. I'm sure it's beautiful on the stage, but all the words that are used in like the stage things are more about like guilt and friendship. And if it were written down to be like longing or something that suggested more love, I would think that maybe that was a subtext of this play. As it is, I think it ends up being more about just showing parts of the wizarding world that would be cool to see on stage.
Oh, that's so reductive.
Well,
okay.
Well, no, but like the trolley, there's a part about the trolley witch where it turns out she's a monster. And that feels really J.K. Rowling to me, where she's like, here's something that I could never say. You know, I never got into one of my Pottermore dictionaries. And, you know, they were able to make that into a scene and set a scene on the top of the train. But I think there's enough emphasis on like here, you know, everybody's cursed children. But then the rest has to be done in these plot mechanics to show us Voldemort or Dumbledore or Polyjuice Potion.
It definitely has a note of the Star Wars Force Awakens syndrome, which is let's harken back to the first book and the next book and the next book and the next book. Like, let's link this kind of an ode to all of Harry Potter while also extending it and pushing it forward into a new generation. It's its own beast while completely being in debt to the original Potter stories. But I mean, I wouldn't knock it for having kind of clunky dialogue, because unless we see it performed, I don't think we'll ever know what it's like. This is not J.K. Rowling's literary dialogue. It's meant to be performed. It's meant to be spoken. You really have to kind of put yourself in that.
To that point, I guess, as a way to close, I've heard great success from people who've got together to read it to each other, more so than I've heard from people who spend it overnight.
I like that.
So like maybe take some time and get together and you guys could all help yourself through something you either see as great or all mourn after it's done and pretend it never exists. But that sounds cool to me.
This book really made me feel for Malia Obama, who was caught twerking at Lollapalooza. That's what I really felt during reading this book. She's
talking about the pressure of being the child of the most famous person.
I was talking a lot about Harry Potter and him being kind of broken and bad father. But like Albus, the whole story there is like, how do you operate when you're the kid of the most famous person in the world who's a total hero and everyone loves you? Like, you cannot do anything. You must be so immobilized. I have no idea how that girl grows up normal. Sad. Go twerk.
Sad.
Sad.
Did you call her Hillary? Malia?
Crooked Hillary's doing it again. Sad.
Malia Obama?
Malia.
Isn't it Malia? Malia.
It's also, there was another word that you all mispronounced that made me...
You all? How
yes,
dare
you?
All.
It's like what several was it? Of you. Oh, I can't remember, but I was like, you know what? Life's too short, man. Just roll with it.
So this weekend, you know, Bourne was a huge hit, kind of huge. It was the biggest in Bourne history, but it wasn't that big compared to all the summer movies. So I don't know. Congratulations, Jason Bourne, probably getting another sequel to that movie at some point. But another kind of big quiet success was Bad Moms. Subtitle part or the logline was Party Like a Mother. I don't know. That's quite a comedy.
You see, that's implying something after afterwards.
Oh, I see. I'm now detecting the joke there. I just thought it was
Party
Like
left
a Mother,
the word
which
out of
fun.
A colloquialism.
No, it's clever. It works both ways.
Oh my God! Wow, this is because this comedy is so deep. Bad Moms flourished at the box office. Apparently, according to Box Office Mojo, it was made for about $20 million, and it has already made $23 million, which means it's probably going to go rise for the next month and do very well as far as comedies are concerned. Bad Moms got some good reviews. I'm shocked. I don't know what it takes to impress people during this kind of the doldrums of summer. But this movie's horrible. I really, really wanted to like this movie, especially because I like everyone in it. I think Mila Kunis and Catherine Hahn and Kristen Bell and Christina Applegate, all these gals, they're fantastic in this movie. They're really good performers. The movie is dreadful because these two dudes who made it, John Lucas and Scott Moore, I don't know if you saw 21 and Over. It was an atrocity. I mean, everything I don't like about bro humor and male fantasy stuffed into this college, like, faux noir. Just horrible movie.
Can we have a moratorium on, like, bad any of that? Like, it's...
Well, certainly this won't be the end of it because it did well. People like Bad. And, you know, I know why people like Bad. Because this is this is a very sitcom-y movie. I can imagine, I was really trying to take myself out of the bubble while watching this movie. If I was, I don't know, wall-to-wall, like, taking my kids to this activity, taking my kids to that activity. This is my date night. I'm going out. I'm seeing my life, like, torn to bits and put back together in a raucous party movie. You know what? Maybe I'd think it was hilarious and I'd go home and go to sleep and go back to my life. I really wanted to put myself there. But this movie is atrocious. There are like three or four different slow motion sequences of straight up partying set to pop music pulled off top 20 radio
right
now.
Is this segment just we shit on Bad Moms?
No, this is not. I have a question for you. Okay. I have a question.
Is there a needle scratch in the movie?
David, be patient. Stop being such a bad host. My question to you guys is this. So because this is male fantasy, you know, kind of filtered through mothers partying, and watching moms be how men would want them to. I'm curious, is there a way to get this kind of raucous behavior and spin it into something really fun? Is being bad like fun anymore? Have you seen it recently? How can it be done really well?
Well, there's a movie called Suicide Squad that's coming out this week, where the premise is that the characters are bad guys. And you know that because one of them says, "We're bad guys." And then a few minutes later, another one of them says, "I swear this happens. Don't forget, we're the bad guys." And the weird thing is, the movie is so generic that, like, you actually... it's a totally legitimate concern that you could have forgotten that they're the bad guys because they act and behave like the good guys in every other superhero movie. So that's a movie that I think speaks to Matt's point that having this bad behavior and really leaning into it and endorsing it and not endorsing it, but sort of milking it for all it is worth on screen is fun. It's also very hard to pull off because I think the temptation is to... I didn't see Bad Moms, but I think the temptation is to bring it back around and redeem them to the point where they really were just flawed characters like anyone else and were rebels.
But they're not really bad in Bad Moms, right? They're just like...
It's more like, Bad Teacher or like Sisters or...
But she was a bad teacher. Like the Bad Moms idea, my sense is that like they're sort of poking fun at the idea of these like perfect cookie cutter moms who follow every blog tip and every whatever. And like these moms are real people. And, like, that's the idea.
No, but don't they go to, like, extremes and trash things? Like, I'm just really tired of watching adults trash things. Like, Christmas Office Party or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Where I'm
it's
like,
exactly that.
Like, Christmas Office Party. Is that what it's called, right? Christmas Party? Yes. Christmas Office Party? Like, it's all these comedians you like in a premise that looks so mind-numbingly dumb. Like, I just don't need to see any more comedians I like throwing shit
it's
out of
all,
windows.
Yeah, it's all slow motion
property.
Drinking
it's just
handles of vodka
damage.
And destroying
and it's
things.
Like, it's not interesting to me, and I don't know if that just makes you sound really elderly. I will say the last time that I probably enjoyed people being quote-unquote bad is what started all of this, I think, which is The Hangover. Like, I like the original.
No, it goes much further than that. Think of the old school. Think of the slow motion scene
old
filmed
school.
In my old, my beloved college bar of 1020 in that other Will Ferrell movie, The Other Guys? Where, The Other Guys, with that long, CGI stitched together slow motion take of them all vomiting in the bar.
Oh, God.
This goes... You know,
but okay, but I don't like old school.
But totally fine.
But I do like the hang. Like Patches asked, is there a time that this was done that you liked? And I guess The Hangover, mostly because the point of that is like they were bad and now they're trying to put their
right.
shit together. But like this whole trend of like adults letting loose and isn't it hilarious? I don't find hilarious. And I, don't
I
know
like
if that makes
1993's Grumpy Old Men. But its sequel, Grumpier Old Men, is horrible.
I'm not sure how much old slow motion drinking to David Guetta songs they did in Grumpier Old Men.
What about Bad Grandpa? I didn't see
not
Bad
enough,
Grandpa.
If you ask
not
me.
Enough.
Bad Grandpa.
Yeah,
and then the same theory is, what is it like? It's not Zachy Mary Me or Porno. It's those two guys need a wedding date, right? Like, isn't the point of that like these two girls are bad? Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick, they drink and do shit. Like, I guess Neighbors is a good example of that, right? Like, we enjoy Seth Rogen and Rose watching them like Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne party, and then like grapple with adulthood.
Yeah,
like,
maybe, but those are definitely
right
my least favorite moments of, especially Neighbors 2, seeing Seth Rogen back at the party, slow motion, like smoking pot and shit. I'm just like, I'm done. Am I too old? I think that's where this is going. Are we done?
Yeah,
I think for you, for Neighbors, in some respects, and you're not going to go with me here, but I think in some respects, the problem might be that you're actually not old enough. I think that there is, and what do I know? I don't have a kid. I don't know. But, I think that as I get older, the joy in sort of like tongue-in-cheek being air quotes young and not air quotes dumb is a lot more real, and like you sort of do things with a twinge of irony of like, it's silly that we're so old now and we're still doing this, but we feel tired at 9 o'clock. Like, I think the older you get, the more relatable a lot of that stuff will become.
And but maybe that speaks to Bad Moms too.
I just think it should be relegated to a montage, like Office Space, like beating the shit out of a fax machine, should be a montage. It shouldn't
be
like an entire movie.
To a montage.
That's probably true.
To to David Gay.
No, we just have to wait for Patches to get pregnant, and then he'll be like, I'm finally away from the baby. I got to go party at the club. And then we'll have to go with him.
That is exactly how it's going to go down. Well, see, David, I did have a point here. I wanted to hear what you guys thought about being bad. And I also want to hear...
moving the conversation.
I hear you. I also want to hear from our listeners. So if you see bad moms, tell me, am I too old? Am I too young? Do I not understand what being bad is anymore? You tell us.
Bad sex tape. Bad.
I see
this
it.
Is bad. This is 40. Bad.
Here's $40 million. Please make this movie. Thank you.
Bad Field of Dreams.
Bad Field of Dreams.
Be like, oh god, you built it, but fuck, we have to
trash it. Bad All the President's Men. All right.
Should I start this? David, do you have a angle into this?
Well, my real angle was just that someone was complaining to us about talking about politics on the show, and I wanted a space to talk. You know, now that we live in these hyper-politicized times, more than ever, it seems.
Now more than ever, yes.
That I think, you know, everyone's free to enjoy movies in their own way, but I think that it is a bit of a fallacy to think that you can extrapolate politics from art of any kind, even if it's a piece of art that is engineered for the pop sphere and does not, you know, have any sort of political overtones to it.
Are you talking about just watching a general anything like intake of art? You're going to apply your own politics to it.
I'm not saying that you necessarily have to aggressively, explicitly, and knowingly apply your politics to something while you're watching it. I'm just saying that when people do make that choice to sort of speak to it in a political context, you don't necessarily have the right, Donald Trump, but you don't have the
moral high ground.
You don't have much firm ground to say, like, come on, guys, keep your politics out of this. That's like saying, like, come on, like, don't talk about color in this movie or light or like the music. I mean, like, it's a very real element in the ether of everything that we do and everything we touch. I mean, it's a very, I'm not the first by any stretch of the imagination to suggest that all movies are inherently political on some level.
This is a film predominantly podcast. This is a great culture, I will say, podcast. Definitely most people listen to me just talk about one stupid fantasy TV show that we all like called Game of Thrones, and they get very mad whenever I bring politics into it, especially like the political election. And it sort of bleeds over into my Twitter feed, where like a bunch of conservative people who love to hear me talk about Game of Thrones get really bummed out when I talk about how much I like Hillary Clinton. And it's like, I'm like, okay, but the point that's maybe getting too personal and away from the point that I agree with you that like, I don't know that I know how to talk about culture, be it film, television, what have you, without putting on the lens of like politics, especially since politics are so much on our mind right now with the election. And so I understand like we get reviews on a number of podcasts across this network saying, this is my one break from talking about politics. I just want to hear you guys talk about movies. And I get that sentiment, but I don't know how to turn it off, and I don't know that I would want to, I guess, is my point.
I mean, I certainly don't want to turn off viewer listeners, and I don't want to suggest by any stretch of the imagination that every time you listen to this podcast, even in the next few months, where I think it's understandably going to be a lot more heightened in that regard than it has been in the past, that we are just going to shove politics down your throat and make sure that it's the forefront of every conversation we have. I don't want viewers to feel that way. I want them to feel like they can, or listeners, I keep saying viewers. I want them to feel like they can, put on their show and just sing at the entertainment. But I do think that when we speak so much about how to watch things, and I do think that it is an active denial of what goes into the making of a movie, of a TV show, whatever, to suggest that it is possible to extricate politics from the text of it. It doesn't mean that always has to be the lens through which you look at that movie or show, but to deny that it's there, that it's not fundamental to the shaping of whatever work. I mean, whether you're talking about a Dinesh D'Souza doc, which is wears its politics on its sleeve, to put it lightly, or Suicide Squad, or whatever the latest blockbuster is, where all those politics are sort of, I don't know, woven into like the Viola Davis character or equivalent. You know, they are there. And I think that it's something that people have to reckon with.
Patches, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Is this something that you could turn off or on? Like, if there's no if there's no obvious political window in the movie, if the movie isn't suggesting this reading, is it accurate to assume that you can't turn it off?
The problem is, I don't think Hollywood gives as much choice at the moment to turn it off. I mean, the other night I was watching Gods of Egypt, which is great, by the way. Be on the right side of history. Be on the right side of history when it comes to Gods of Egypt.
Patches has a lot of fun. This movie since day one.
No, I haven't. I just saw it for the first time.
Then who was it? Jordan, who was
our colleague Jordan Hoffman, who's been on the show many times, has enjoyed it. Amy Nicholson, now of MTV,
enjoys Gods of Egypt.
No, I love Amy to death. But if she likes it, it is a good chance that is the American Ultra Syndrome.
It is no Jupiter Ascending, but Gods of Egypt is pretty damn fun. But I will say this, I'm watching it and I'm like, this is Gerard Butler is the Trump faction right now in the begin. So the story of Gods of Egypt is that Nicolaj Coster-Waldau, your boy from Game of Thrones, he plays Horus. He's going to be anointed king of Egypt. He's a god, of course. And here comes Set, played by Gerard Butler, and he comes out of nowhere, his uncle. And he basically says, there's been 1,000 years of peace in Egypt. What the fuck? Like, stand aside. There's no reason why there would be this much peace in Egypt. We have to conquer the rest of the world. Why are you just sitting on your ass? And it's basically like, make Egypt great again. Let's keep going. Let's push this thing. Ignore the fact that this has been totally fine, on the rise, and now stamp out the enemy that doesn't really exist, that we're going to make up. And it just feels so political and relevant to what we're watching in the real sphere. And of course, this came out in February. I mean, there was no real time to plan this as a election allegory, but there it is. And so how do you back away from that? I don't think you can, because it's built into what people are making out there in Hollywood. You can't possibly ignore it. Where else can the filmmakers draw from except the real life? If they are reflecting real life in every bit of movie they're making, how do you create pure escapism? We kind of talked about this on a previous episode, but it seems almost impossible.
Well, I mean, see, that's the interesting thing is that what you said about it, they couldn't have possibly known, but it can be flawlessly applied or applied well enough. Just makes me think that it's just an application. Like, I could go back to my home movies of my second birthday and decide it's political and do a really deep critical reading of it, and maybe I find something, but that's a filter I put on it. It's not like, you know, if I'm watching, I'm trying to think of like the most non-political thing in my life. Like, trying to make Sandlot about the 2016 election would be difficult.
Sandlot,
like, is Donald Trump the one who has the ball, or is Donald Trump one of the kids who's trying to
No, Sandlot is about making America great again.
It is.
But if political narratives are shaped out of the same building blocks that fictional narratives are, then how can we differentiate the two? Of course they'll come back and back, because Trump and Hillary both, let me be apolitical here, they're both using narrative archetypes to build these stories and chase the position they're after. They're both fundamentally the same.
I do wonder though, if it's hard for conservatives, and there are a lot of conservatives out there that I respect, if it's hard for them to engage in a world where the liberal bent is assumed, which it is in both Hollywood and like the discussion thereof, And so that if that's alienating in some way, and I'm talking about like fiscal conservatives, not people who like, you know, hate gay people or are racist.
No, because
but, like,
there are no Trump supporters who you respect. Who understand.
Right. That. Right. So like, you know, like that, if that's hard, if like my, you know, de facto assumption that everyone who wants to talk to me also thinks Hillary might be an okay idea. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting.
I mean, I think to what Patches was saying and to really to where you come from, Joanna, in terms of well, to really what everyone was saying. I mean, so like Joanna, the Game of Thrones is the go-to reference in articles, Slate articles or whatever articles, when people, even tweets, when people want to say like they want to apply it to the election. They say, you know, Game of Thrones is like the 2016 election. Donald Trump is this character and Hillary Clinton is this character. And everyone knows Game of Thrones. We all speak that language. And so we all have a good laugh. And that, of course, was a story that was written long before. Actually, Donald Trump has been throwing his hat to the political arena since before Game of Thrones existed, but not successfully. But, you know, I think that to what Dave was saying, it's less about these stories being written with particular things in mind, because that isn't really going to age. It's more like they are sieves for frameworks for these things that we can pin them on. And so, like, yeah, you probably could find a political application to the video of your home video from being 2 years old and running around your in your I mean, you are a
what kind
Latino
of underpants? Let's be
You're
clear here.
You're a Latino American. How is any representation of you visually not inherently political these days? I mean, ditto a white person. I mean, I think like this is it's that's the politics have become so corrosive and all encompassing that particularly when race is involved, I mean, I think that they are.
But does that become? Is there a reverse? I mean, is there a problem with this, David? Can it bleed too far into everything and cloud what these stories are really about? Do films need to be political in order to make sense and be relevant, or can they stand aside from these issues, and can we kind of quell our feelings about politics to really understand them on a character level of some sort? Or is, I mean, are we our politics?
I don't think that's mutually exclusive. Like, I don't think seeing it through a political lens prevents one from seeing it on a character level.
I mean, if you're watching a video of Baby Dave running around and you're seeing it from the like Latino American point of view, that's what I'm kind of jumping off of. But I'm seeing that through
called,
all movies.
Oh, what was it called? It was about these two women, and they liked each other, and it was like the 50s in New York.
Oh,
it'll come
Sarah,
to me.
Sarah.
Blue Lauren? Is the warmest color.
Lauren?
Daryl? Like, okay, so like, you know, a film like Carol. This is a film that comes out in the year. Actually, I can't remember if it was 2014 or 2015. That this is my privilege as a straight person, that I can't remember exactly what year gay marriage was legalized as the law of the land.
Last but, year.
You know, this movie, you know, the what was that?
Last year, 2015.
It was 2015. Yeah.
So yeah, the movie came out in that year. This is a story, of course, adapted from a film adapted from a story that was written in 1951. And but you know, and that is a movie that I connected to on like a deep personal emotional level, and was not thinking of it in political terms. But there is. You know, there's the politics of it all are sort of baked right into it, into the oppression that keeps them apart and makes it such a risk for them to express an interest in being together. It is a political statement, unfortunately, and like so many, you know, it's unfortunate that any image of race, whether white, Latino, or otherwise, is political, or that sexuality is politicized, because until we live in a world where all things are considered equal, they will be. And so it is unfortunate, in my estimation, that any of these things can be politicized, but they are. And I think that you probably don't see too many neoconservatives who think that Carol is a beautiful, moving love story. You know, I think that like, but that's not the lens through which I appreciate it through any of the four times I saw it. I mean, it's sort of baked into the text, but I'm not sitting there thinking, you know, like, oh man, this is like so time, you know, it was, now it's in production and now it's being released because of how the country is moving forward. I mean, yes, that's my go-to example, but I'm just trying to think of something where those lenses are not mutually exclusive and they are compatible. And you can think of them in different ways. And I think that you could go home and you could write a piece about Suicide Squad that opens my eyes. It's like totally, you're really sticking your neck out. And you're saying like, no, man, here's what Suicide Squad says about the election. Like, it's deep. I'm going to find it. Here's the truth. It's like that bullshit piece that I still believe in and liked, but a lot of people thought was bullshit, and I'm totally cool with that, about Godzilla, about being like the post-human blockbuster. It's like, that's how I saw it, and I made my case. And it sways some people fine. If it doesn't, fine. But, you know, I think that like you can transpose these readings onto everything.
Right, but the reverse is also, it gets under your skin. I think you get upset when people don't want to talk about politics with movies.
I get upset when they think that it is valid to, not just to say I don't want to talk about this, because like there are any number of things that I don't want to talk about in regards to movies or anything else, but in saying that we are somehow bringing something that is alien to the discussion because it comes from a place of like personal agenda into the conversation, as if it were not implicitly there, like anything that's part of the mise-en-scène or the acting or anything else.
I mean, I guess the devil's advocate on the side of like a listener to this podcast that doesn't have the same political beliefs we are, I believe to a certain extent we could toggle that. Like, no one's going to blame you, David, for having the opinions that they do if they know you, or if they do, they're still going to leave us 5 stars. They're just going to tell us how much they hate you. But
I hope so. If you hate me, please do still leave 5 stars. Yeah. Just tell me how much you hate me.
But I think it's like your choice to, you know, apply the reading. And at least if I could, you know, apply political readings to different things. And it's like, even if we go back to the example of my home movies, which is stupid, I'm not seeing it the same way politically you are, because I am literally seeing myself and you're seeing a Latin American child represented somehow. So that's interesting to you.
Can
it's
you
completely
post
normal
these
to
home
me.
Movies yeah, on our website? Say, so we have
I have some home movies, and sure. yeah.
But does this...
I think I have one where I admit to hurting my brother by throwing something at his face. But if you could take it away, then isn't it reasonable for us to not necessarily bring that to a movie that isn't there?
But why is that
consideration?
Something?
I suppose
I totally think it's fair to not want to, like, and this is why I totally sympathize with viewers or listeners. I'm always going to call them viewers who say, who are just not interested in having that layer transposed over a particular movie because they want their break away from politics. What irks me is the thought that it is not a proper part of the conversation. That is something that we are forcing onto it.
But it is a scary part of the conversation, right? If for some reason the read of a film that you are reading as political is against someone else's political ideology, then that can get very uncomfortable very quickly. We can bond over movies, but they can also divide us. You know, Dave and I spent the weekend warring with my Trump-loving extended family on Facebook. Yes, this actually happened. And I tried to kind of deflate the situation by bringing up Star Trek, of all things. There's something that could unite us, because my uncles, they love Star Trek. Grew up loving Star Trek. I love Star Trek. Dave loves Star Trek. And I thought that would actually clear the air. Star Trek, you know, we were talking about it during the Comic-Con podcast. Brian Fuller brought up, I mean, this is something that's very progressive and pushing the envelope. Unity, unity, unity. And for my extended family who loves Trump, they saw Star Trek as this kind of militaristic, imposed unity
And
brought,
I don't think
like,
they know how the Borg works. It was so frustrating.
Yeah, that really put the spotlight on the disunity of our current universe. I'm like, holy shit! You know, this is just creating fissures in our pop culture, but I mean, it's important, too.
If they actually didn't know, if they were, like, wrong about something on an objective level, if they didn't know how the Borg work, whatever the fuck the Borg are, then...
You don't know what the Borg are?
Let's not get off track here. Then that is frustrating, but otherwise, I think it's really interesting, and this is something that I would entertain. I mean, like, we are... Because, and I like to say inflammatory things, because I think that I'm mostly playing to the crowd here, but, like, we are all... right-thinking, liberal-minded people. But I think that it would be, theoretically, interesting to have somebody on this podcast, or maybe somebody listening who wants to leave us a 5-star review that says, in addition to that, you know, that they interpreted maybe because of their political beliefs, a movie that we discussed in a very different way that doesn't obscure the facts of the movie, like The Borg.
Well, the 13 hours review certainly people going.
I will say this. My favorite person to talk, one of my favorite people to talk about movies with is like my best friend's brother, who happens to be conservative, but not.
His name is Sean Hannity.
An asshole. And like we'll go see like Avatar or Captain America Civil War or whatever, these like big blockbusters with like clear political undertones together, and then have a rip-roaring debate about it. I find it so fun. But I also understand why, especially if you feel in the minority in a community, which for once in their lives conservatives might find themselves being, like,
I'm sure they do.
That it would feel uncomfortable and shitty. I get it.
Well, I think that, like, that's another thing that I would be really interested in. I mean, I wish... I don't know if between us we could scrounge up... I mean, actually, not between me. This is just how close-minded my life and circles are. I have, like, one Republican friend.
Yeah, your token Republican friend.
You
like
are
a fiscal Republican friend.
Really deep in the bubble. You're down in the abyss, brother.
Yeah, but I do think that it would be really interesting to have someone either on this show or elsewhere sort of write about or talk about their experiences as a conservative, experiencing entertainment. Because the entertainment industry, or the arts in general, of course, lean so far to the left, because these are all of our interesting creative minds who are about love and humanity and not governed by hate. And to sort of reconcile and their love for entertainment in a way that isn't just shutting down or blocking things out. I mean, I think a lot of the times, the Borg example, whatever the case might be, if you're coming from that perspective, you have to sort of turn off part of your brain in order to enjoy it. It's like, how do you, like Chris Christie and Bruce Springsteen, I mean, like, how, you don't have to endorse the artists, of course, but, like, some of those songs lean very much to the left. And, like, how would it be for me if I were listening to Radiohead and I thought that global warming was a myth and they're singing about denial on House of Cards and I'm like, he's not talking about that. He's talking about denial. I know objectively he's talking about that, but like there's room for me to interpret it otherwise, but you would have to really bend over. I mean, there's plenty. You can be denial about anything, but you really have to bend over backwards to do that time and time and time again. And it must be exhausting. And I'd be really interested to hear about that.
I'd also like, I'm having trouble right now thinking of people, creative, interesting people in Hollywood who are also conservatives who don't make me want to, like, you know, peel my face off like James Woods or something like that. Like, you know, they're, every time I find out someone in Hollywood is a conservative, it's usually from like reading their Twitter feed and I want to cry. So like, but I know there, like, hashtag not all conservatives. I know there must be like some really interesting, great, conservatives contributing to
Kurt Sutter a Republican?
No.
Oh. No, that was the only.
And I'm
one
not talking about like people who are iffy about voting for Hillary. I'm talking about people who are like, you know, fighting the liberal. I mean, sorry, they're rather the social conservatives. The people who.
Well, you guys have to know those people, like.
But it'd be good. It would be good for us.
Like pro life. You know, trans people secretly weird me out. You get like those people are all around.
It's
right?
hard for me though because like, and I don't say this is something that I'm proud of necessarily as far as my closed-mindedness goes, but it would be really difficult for me to be close with somebody who was anti-choice. I mean, like, that is important to me, and I just think it represents like a fundamental.
When I was in New York, I was talking to somebody that two of us on this podcast besides me probably know, and like just didn't understand, like, you know, talking about how to talk about trans issues and was coming off wrong. And, you know, so we just had to, like, talk about that. And it came up because we were talking about movies and tranny came up. And I was like, it had to, you know, stop and do the thing. But, like, those people are around. I think, like, what I'm worried about this year is because everything's so supercharged. That layer goes on everything. So, you know, you can't have a nuanced opinion about anything in media this year. Because fuck it, it's Donald Trump or it's Hillary Clinton.
I guess
Bernie Sanders.
I didn't want to start this conversation and suggest this conversation should mean that like every movie needs to be hyper polarized in that way and say, like, no, this movie is saying this is about Trump, and it can be construed to be like really aggressive about one thing or the other. I'm trying to come at it from as nonpartisan a place as possible and just saying that movies are a result of or reflection of the time in which they're made, even no matter when they're set, if they take place in a fictional kingdom. Arts reflect, even subconsciously, even if it's not the author's intention, the times around them. And that can be for good, it can be for bad, it can be overt, it can be, you know, subtle so that you can't even notice it. But I just think it's frustrating to say that, like, no, this should not be a part of the conversation. Well, it doesn't need to be part of every conversation, has a place there.
What worries you is when people, like, reject the empathy in criticism, which we hopefully try to inherently
but
have.
But they're likely
at least
rejecting the criticism of ideology that they oppose, right? They're seeing you transpose your thoughts onto something that they just want to remain escapism, right? These movies aren't necessarily bringing like bipartisanship to the table. And I would be curious if there, and maybe as a way of wrapping up, if there are movies that seem to transcend the polarizing effect of politics that, you know, both sides of the line could objectively agree on somehow. And I'll let you dwell on that for 2 seconds, but something that comes to mind, we made a joke about it earlier, but something like All the President's Men feels like a movie that almost no matter where you stand on the political spectrum at this point, you could get behind that movie. That is a movie about truth. It is a movie about serious reporting. You know, the media is constantly under fire in this election. How can you possibly, I mean, I would be curious if there are people who would put that movie in their crosshairs, but like, those are two guys just trying to beat the system, and I feel like everyone could get behind that. I don't know. And that would really bring people together, and it would be hard to politicize and polarize there. Are there other movies like that that you guys can think of?
I mean, I think that there are some people who would not think All the President's Men is like, aren't there people who think Nixon was like framed or something? I don't know. Like,
there are definitely people who think Nixon was a very good president.
And yeah,
he wasn't. I mean, as
if
someone
you can
who has
think
visited
there are
Nixon's
people who think
library,
I'm not sure that. I think you'd have to like transcend politics. I think you have to go with something like, I don't know, like what Dave brought up earlier, which I'm thinking of baseball movies like Field of Dreams and Sandlot. Like, those seem like neutral American territory for some reason. Maybe I'm wrong, but
not anymore.
I don't know. I mean, like, everything could be problematized. So my answer is going to be everything. Like, everything could be done. If, like, if we want to talk about how Sandlot's about a whole bunch of white kids and, like, none of them, like, it's about having,
no,
like,
the
priceless
best,
autographed baseball, we can, but there's no reason
to. The best player is not white. That might have sounded like tokenism, but
so
maybe it was. But we don't need to think about that. If we don't.
Benny, right? Like, he's not anyway.
It's something. It's different for something like Star Trek Into Darkness, which is trying so hard to say something about 9/11. But I think for most movies, unless it's inherently there, it's for everyone. I think it's like the public conversation that happens around it. The Expendables versus Scott Pilgrim that one weekend that we never talk about ever again because that's less important.
Benny Rodriguez, best player on the Sandlot team.
He was really good. He was really fast.
Here's my addition to this conversation, which is that The Rock is a conservative who I can get behind, who's famous.
Is he
in
still?
Hollywood.
Do you know that? I know he spoke at a GOP, or he spoke at the RNC in 2004, I want to say.
Yeah, I think he's, I mean, like, you know, socially liberal.
He's very big on the military. Mm. This is far removed from where this started, but I don't imagine a world where he would vote for Donald Trump.
No, but we're not talking about only Trump supporters. We're talking about, like,
but I
you
think
know.
I can picture him, from what little I know of The Rock, being used to considering himself a Republican. I think he may not go out of his way to identify himself as such these days.
Well, you heard it here. The Rock.
The Rock, if you're out there and you want to come on the show and tell us all about your politics, because how could that not benefit your career?
Bring the people together, Mr. Rock.
For tonight, in honor of Moanoa, the Rock telling you about racism.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back. We will be back later this week to do a review of Suicide Squad. We've been very busy and missing some review episodes and not getting to the shitty shit that keeps coming out. But hey, Suicide Squad, this one demands our attention. So we'll be tackling that later this week. In the meantime, why don't we tell people who we are and where they can find us?
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA70. You can find my writing at geek.com. You could find the podcasting at fightinginthewarroom.com. That includes this podcast, Storm of Spoilers, did a podcast called Thought Bubble for a while, did some Star Wars specials, and you could still find the, 18-part audiovisual essay on the plot of Lost.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me at IndieWire, where I wrote about a movie at length today, Indignation, which is not Suicide Squad. I wrote a long profile about its writer-director, former CEO of Focus Features, and current professor at Columbia, James Shamus, about the death of cinema and how it may already be dead, but it's actually not as doom and gloomy as it sounds. Check it out. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. If you want to hear Dave and myself talk more about the AMC series Preacher, or the upcoming film Suicide Squad, or maybe some Hamilton or Laika or Stranger Things or all that kind of nonsense, you can listen to us over on the Storm Spoilers podcast. We're running all summer with a variety of topics. And if you miss Katie Rich's voice like I do, you should go listen to old episodes of Fighting the Worm at fightingtheworm.com.
There will be Laika on this podcast as well.
We Laika the Laika.
That's all I can say.
Okay.
Kubo. All right.
I am Matt Patches, and I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. Oh yeah, I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. You can find what we are lightning round. This just is a disaster. What is this week's lightning round question, Dave? Answer it.
In honor of Suicide Squad, what cinematic villain deserves a turn as the hero for a change?
Yes, answer that one on Twitter, and we will be back later this week with your answers. Bye-bye.
If he stays, I'll wait for him. Pieces of life. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life. If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life.